40 years, 50 years ago, you know what was weird? Eating yogurt.
Some days I still think eating yogurt is weird.
This is the new thing, yogurt.
Some people cannot accept yogurt, like, genetically. I don't think they can. It's really weirdly tart and textural. I like yogurt.
How was it sold? It was sold that there's this little town in Russia where the people live to be 100 years old because they eat yogurt.
Yeah.
I'm Hugh Atchison, and this is Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot. You may or may not know me from Top Chef or Top Chef Masters or Iron Chef Canada, or from eating food at my restaurants 5 and 10 in the National in Athens, or Empire State South in Midtown Atlanta, or having coffee at Spiller Park Coffee in Atlanta, 2 locations. And I've written some books, a number of them. But in this show, you know, it's funny, I'm not really judging or cooking, at least not cooking much. I'm more listening and talking and learning. I'm connecting with old friends and meeting new people. I taped 14 conversations all over New York during 2 recent trips there, and it's really been a great personal experience. I got to catch up with Alex Stupak and Dan Barber at their restaurants, and Carla Hall at a great little place called Home Sweet Harlem. And I ate an amazing sandwich with New York Magazine food critic Adam Platt at Celeste Tong's Little Tong Noodle Shop in Midtown. That sandwich was amazing. I also have episodes from time to time in Athens, Georgia, where I'm sitting right now in my apartment. It's the place I call home. I'm really excited to get these conversations out into the world. So here we go. For episode 1, I went to visit my dear friend Tom Colicchio at his beautiful modernist brownstone near Fort Greene Park in Brooklyn. We talk about restaurants and the new season of Top Chef and a little about politics. So here's episode 1. Tom Colicchio heats up leftovers.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
It's really interesting right now in an age, in an economic reality of having a really, really historically low unemployment rate. Mm-hmm. How do we find chefs?
Well, finding cooks is hard.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to be a chef. A two-year cook all of a sudden wants to be a chef. They don't even want to be sous chefs anymore. They just want to skip right over.
Well, no, they want to skip right to Top Chef.
Well, yeah.
As a host.
Yeah. You know, finding cooks, it's just becoming really difficult. And partly because you can cook anywhere now. It used to be if you were cooking, you know, you wanted to be in the big markets. You wanted to be in New York, San Francisco, Chicago, L.A., you know. And
but now you cook in Minneapolis.
Nowadays,
Cincinnati.
There's great restaurants everywhere. Yeah. You don't need to, you know, as a young person, you don't need to, number one, come here and live, you know, 6 to an apartment in Queens and sort of deal with the harshness of the city. And so, yeah, you can cook anywhere.
But is that reality of growing up as a young cook and working 80 hours a week and really putting in your time and your penance and learning the stress of that, has that all gone away in our industry? I mean, has it changed so much that we can't work people like that anymore?
People don't want to work like that anymore.
No, they don't.
When I worked, you know, coming up and I've worked 78 hours a week, it's because I wanted to.
Right.
No one was making me, but the shifts were available and it's fine, I'll work. And for me, it was like, well, once I get past 40, it's time and a half. Fine. Let's work some hours.
Yeah.
And nowadays, it's like, I think people are okay working 30. It's like, oh, you know, 34 hours, I'm fine. I'm done.
Are we slowly becoming European?
Maybe.
It's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing.
Maybe not. I'm not sure. But I
really think that finding, and you know, I want to pay people a really high wage and make it a very unexploited industry, which historically it has been very exploited. Right. But it's really difficult to find people with a modicum of skill set these days in our industry to man the line and just get bodies.
I think part of the problem is there's too many restaurants. And there's not just restaurants, but then you have the explosion of fast casual. You have various jobs like food styling, and we have a crew. A Top Chef, we had, you know, in the culinary department, it used to be one person. Now it's like 6 people. So there's all kind of ways to sort of work in the industry without working the line at night. And I think that's what, I think that's what we're experiencing, is that there's just somewhat of a shortage, number one. And it's also, it's almost, it's no longer viable to hire undocumented workers.
Right.
It's just the trouble that you can get into is just far exceeds the risk. You know, you can go to jail now for it, and with this administration, they will probably prosecute you as well. So,
not if you hire solely Scandinavian illegal immigrants. Right. They tend to be really. I don't know why, but they seem not to care about that.
Weird. Go figure.
Yeah, it is.
So yeah, it's become increasingly difficult to staff restaurants, and I don't know. I don't see that changing anytime soon, especially now that we're, you know, full employment, essentially, at, you know, 3.7, whatever it is.
Which is totally intriguing to me from a restaurateur standpoint is, like, how do you create then a work environment that's appealing to people that is not about money? You pay them enough to get by and enjoy life and be, provide food for their families and not be in abject poverty. So what is the other part of that equation that means long-term employment for them? It means constantly teaching them. It means piquing their curiosity. It means giving them an endless realm to learn in.
Well, there's definitely upward mobility because you start off as a cook making, you know, $15, $16, $17 an hour, whatever it is. The next step is sous chef, where you're going to make, you know, $50,000 a year plus have benefits, I guess. It's kind of New York City.
Yes. Yeah.
And then you can take that next step to chef. I mean, it's almost you're doubling your salary from going from a sous chef to a chef.
But what are culinary schools teaching these people in that time parameter? Because really, for most people, as young chefdom, that's a 10-year process. Easy.
It used to be.
And now it doesn't seem to be anymore. Expedited.
Yeah. It used to be a 10-year process before you took a sous chef's position. Now it's like, 2 years, I've read a culinary school. I want a sous chef's job.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, to me, like, sous chef was always like this long period of purgatory of having to do pretty much every job in the kitchen and be the demon to everybody and watch over people. So
let's talk about what is a chef now, because it seems to have changed a lot in the last. I mean, a chef was a very regimented position before, but. Because of the success of some television shows that you're guilty of creating, the idea of a chef is completely changed. And I mean, still they should be the leader of a kitchen, right? But now they're asked to be the sort of front of the house.
Well, I mean, you know, I have a different take on the word chef. It simply means boss. It doesn't mean that you all of a sudden have gained some kind of mystical powers in the kitchen and now you have this position. It simply means boss. And so, you know, if Springsteen were French, he'd be called the chef, right? Not the boss.
That's true.
This is true. So all it means is you're running a kitchen. And I'll go as far as say people like Julia Child was never a chef.
No.
She was a teacher. She was a great home cook and teacher and educator. But
by the
she was never a chef because she wasn't running a kitchen.
Was Alice Waters a chef?
She ran a kitchen.
Yeah.
She has a restaurant, and so she's the head of that kitchen, yes.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Whether or not she's there doing it day-to-day, that's irrelevant. I mean, she is running
that Alton kitchen. Brown is not a chef.
He's not a boss of a kitchen. And so, again, I think there's a lot of confusion over what that word means.
Right.
I'm happy. People, you know, it's funny, on social media, every now and then I'll get someone like, you cook? It's like, as if that's an insult.
Right.
They think it's some kind of insult. It's not at all. It's what I do. I'm happy to be called a cook. That's fine with me. Yep. Has the meaning changed? Do you have to wear more hats? I don't know. I think what's really changed I think this is maybe to the detriment of the industry is that, you know, it used to be, you opened a restaurant as a chef restaurateur. That was it. That's what you did. Now we're opening multiple restaurants and I think we're kind of responsible for the boom in the growth of restaurants.
To our detriment.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? We're a victim of our own success.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's changed. And so, yeah, you have to be more of a businessman, but you kind of almost had to before. I think the big thing is you got to be not only, a really tremendous cook, someone who can really organize a kitchen, someone who knows how to hire the right team, someone who can set the right tone, and that's changing quickly. It has changed over the last, 10, 15 years, but with the Me Too movement in restaurants, that's changed very, you know, I think drastically. But you also have to be constantly get out there, you know, deal with social media, deal with Instagram, you know. So there's a lot more. I mean, I think, you know, 30 years ago, there was no social media, there was no Instagram. So that was one part of my day I didn't have to worry about. and so there's a lot more that you have to do to stay successful. I think you have to be a little, you know, multi-dimensional and much more well-rounded than you had to be 30 years ago.
Yeah. It's funny that that idea and those attributes of the successful chef, of to me, I always compare it to triaging. Good chefs triage the situation every day and figure out what needs to be done.
From moment to moment.
Yep. And can make fast, steady decisions to do that. Which goes towards some of what we're seeing in the philanthropic and disaster response for people like Jose Andres, who people are wondering why he's successful in that domain. It's just because of that. He's thinking like a chef when he goes into a situation.
Right, he's a problem solver.
Is what chefs are every day.
Yeah, and also it's like, chefs have been trained in, you know, we have to go and do events somewhere where you're sitting, you're stuck in a hallway somewhere with a Bunsen burner, and you make it work. Yeah. You figure it out.
And you never have any idea of what you're about to go into.
Right.
But also, I think we're good at also, the most overused word of the last 10 years, but we're really good at curating to the audience with a little bit of research as to what they would want to yearn to eat. And I think that's a really important thing in disaster response is you cannot go into Ethiopia and make pork barbecue for 50,000 people. You've cultural sensitivity and understanding, sure, that you should go to Puerto Rico and cook rice and beans and plantains, right, and, you know.
Right. I mean, I found out after 9/11, I was running the night shift in one of the boats that was, you know, feeding the first responders, not to serve rice because it looked like maggots. And they were finding body parts with maggots on them, and people were freaked out. So it was one of those things like, do not serve rice.
Wow.
Yeah. I was like, okay.
But, you know, the U.S. governmental response has always dropped a bunch of MREs and meal kits of super saccharine sweet candy bars and, you know.
Right.
But that's not also our bodies react to food that we're used to. So, sometimes it can be detrimental.
But I think also part of it, and I think, yeah, I talked to Jose last week, and part of it is not only are you feeding people, and I've heard talk about this, not that you're feeding people and just giving them calories, but you're comforting them. And so you want to give them something that they look at as comfort food, something that they could say, you know, things are terrible right now, and we're just getting by day to day. I don't have a roof on my house. I can't find my, you know, family members, and I don't want plastic food that's, you know, going to put calories in me, but it's not something I'm going to remember and think like that's nourishment got me by, you know, that rice and bean dish.
But that's the key word, nourishment.
Right.
Because nourishment is an emotional term as well. I mean, it's, you know, as I say often in cooking demos, we don't make memories over a meal of pizza pockets because they're just, you know, that's the plastic food of our generation. So, but it is amazing to see the engagement of chefs. And then as a percentage, it's always intriguing to me as to why are chefs so progressively active overall? I mean, and maybe it's just because we see them more on social media because those are our channels, but I think it's true that as an occupation, it's interesting that we seem to be more engaged in the process, in the political process, and in the process of sustainability and equality than a lot of other industries. I don't hear a lot about dental hygienists really pushing the envelope.
Yeah.
Because
I think chefs were afforded a platform because of TV and because of other things. And so the profession in general has been elevated. Again, we look at other fields that you're seeing that sort of engagement as well. The arts.
Right.
You're seeing it with artists, you're seeing it with musicians, you're seeing it with actors. And because they have a platform. And I think chefs now have that platform. And so the question is, what do you do with it? And there's a lot of chefs who are progressive. Restaurants that are known also tend to be in cities, mm-hmm, where you find people that are more progressive. And I think it's an industry that attracts people that are more progressive as well. I mean, obviously, this is a, I'm generalizing here.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think that, you know, it'd be great to see someone do a study on how, on who's attracted to the industry and has that changed, you know, since Food TV. But you typically you end up with more progressive people. And I don't know if that's true in other countries. I assume it is, but I don't know.
Yeah. So how do we strip the ostentatiousness of food away from the overall? I mean, we're in fine dining. You know, you're in very fine dining with the flagship of Kraft. Mm-hmm. I'm in relative fine dining that has to meet the needs of a small town mm-hmm. or Atlanta. But they're relatively high-ticket restaurants. Mm-hmm. So how do we strip the ostentatious side of food away and make sure that all of the country has the ability to feed themselves well?
Yeah.
It's a big question. Yeah, so what are the basics?
But I think that's been happening, again, for the last 30 years. So if you look at restaurants like Montrachet and Gotham, when they opened up, they were restaurants that were trying to do everything correct in terms of food and service, but clearly more casual downtown restaurants. When Danny Meyer and I opened Gramercy Tavern, same thing. We wanted to, even though it was expensive, we still wanted to have a sense of casualness where if we didn't have a dress code, if he wanted to come in shorts, we didn't care. And so we're moving that direction. I think if anything, Dave Chang, more than his food, this is something he hit on. Where he, I think, did one of the first restaurants that were really set up for millennials, where you had loud music, and loud music was in other restaurants that I could think of, but you had loud music, you had this big poster of the band, you were sitting on a block of wood, you weren't even in a chair.
It was a block of wood.
Yeah, and it was crammed in and loud, but the food was really yummy, kind of a little off-kilter at times, where there was a real mashup of different cultures and stuff, and it wasn't expensive. And, you know, you can get a...
It's wide spectrum, because you have the ability to spend a lot of money on Momofuku, but you could get away with just getting bowl of ramen.
I'm talking noodle bar and sambar, yeah.
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 I'm not talking about Ko. That's different.
No,
Ko's expensive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But really, you know, just completely went all in for, like, this is my generation. We're not wearing a jacket and tie. He told me a funny story. Henry Kravitz, KKR, was worth $1 gazillion, was trying to get a reservation, couldn't get in there. And he called, finally got through to David somehow and said, I want a reservation. I can't get in. He was like, well, stand in line like everybody else. And he finally got in. And after dinner, he said, you need to charge more money for this. He said, look, you could charge a lot more. And Dave was like, no, but that's why we're
packed.
Yeah. He's like, I understand economics, but that's not what we want to do here.
Yeah.
So, I think if, you know, one of my favorite restaurants in LA is Squirrel, and they do it too. It's not expensive, but it's food that you want to eat.
But Squirrel's an interesting place because it's also breakfast and lunch with really, does Squirrel even sell booze?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think they do.
I don't think so.
But, I mean, you still, with Squirrel, you can get, you can really talk, you can spend a fair bit of money there if you want to, because you want to try a lot of things. And the menu is big, but it's also, I find Jessica Costello, who's the chef and founder of Squirrel, originally started as a jam shop. But the key to Jessica is that she creates food. I can yearn for that food every day of my life.
Yep.
And that's kind of the magic of that food.
Yep.
I could eat it every day.
Yeah.
And rarely can I can't say that about.
Right.
I mean, I don't want to eat pizza every day.
No.
So.
I agree. I mean, there's something, it's something craveable. And it's something you can't put your finger on it, but you don't know why, but it's a combination of textures and flavors, and she uses a lot of fermented product, and everything is slightly different, but not too crazy where it's like, I don't want to do that.
No, and, but the texture, you're right about the texture, you're right, and the acidity, and then the umami fermentation stuff that hints in, but everything's really light in a lot of ways, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and it's a hilarious restaurant because it's tiny and really what a great rent model, because 90% of her seating is on the sidewalk, and she gets away with that beautifully. Yeah. Tom, tell me about the neighborhood we're in. We're in Brooklyn.
We're in Fort Greene.
Okay.
Fort Greene, Brooklyn, yeah. You know, we moved here. We bought this place about 3 years ago. But yeah, Fort Greene's like, you know, one of those neighborhoods. I mean, it borders on Clinton Hill, and then further out is Bed-Stuy.
Yep.
And so yeah, it's like a real neighborhood, and it's also still a mixed neighborhood,
an important part of rap history.
It is actually.
It is.
In fact, where we were living before we moved here, up on St. James Place, that's where Biggie was had a house. But yeah, this was kind of ground zero for Brooklyn rap.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome history.
But yeah, it's like I said, the neighborhood's changing a bit, but it's still retaining a lot of its, you know, character.
Yeah. You got your guitar in the corner. You still listening to Way Too Much Grateful Dead?
I play every day. I haven't listened to the Grateful Dead in a while, but I play every day. And lately, I haven't been up on music. I haven't been. You've
kind of been up on politics these days.
I know, it's hard to.
It becomes a full time job.
Yeah.
On Twitter, responding to people telling us shut up and cook.
It's always.
What's
great.
The best response you have to people telling you to shut up and cook?
It all depends on the person who tells me to shut up and cook. Sometimes I'm like, yeah, I'll make you a sandwich. And other times it's like, you know, I'm just exercising my First Amendment right. It's a bitch, isn't it? It's a lot, what I've done lately is like, wow, I've never heard that one before. And then they'll delete the tweet and they're embarrassed.
John Kerry responded to someone yesterday. One of the Fox News people was making light of John Kerry and trying to insult him. John Kerry does have a bronze star and three purple hearts, the Valor Award in battle. And he responded with, well, I'm really glad that my fight in Vietnam gave you the right to be a fool on Twitter.
Right. Yep.
And it was pretty concise and really to the point. I mean, very Secretary of State material.
Yeah.
So.
Presidential material too.
Yeah,
apparently
he was at one point.
Apparently, he may be running along with 20 other people.
Yeah,
his name keeps coming up.
I think he is like 95, but he's very super amazing person. Let's go to the kitchen.
Yeah.
So this kitchen is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I kind of went a little.
You went a little crazy?
Not crazy. The space was the right space. So
it's a good submarine shape.
Yeah,
it's a luxurious submarine.
Yeah. So what are we gonna cook here?
I don't know. I don't think we have to cook. Let's just snack.
Well, snack. All right.
Let's snack.
There's some stuff.
It's easy.
I have leftovers. I like leftovers. Oh, here, I want you to try this. This is.
Tom is pulling out a murky thing of.
No, this is
a small vessel.
Nope.
This is a small vessel.
It's small.
It's got a red liquid in it.
It's homemade hot sauce.
Labeled as hot sauce.
My homemade hot sauce.
Is it fermented?
It is fermented. Go easy.
What are the peppers?
That's a good question. I don't know.
It's hot as hell.
It's hot as hell. Yeah. Now, the reason I say I don't know is I'm still looking. I have a here.
I will proudly announce to America that Tom's fridge is much like everyone else's fridge in this world, where it's condiment rich. A couple of lost leftovers in the back.
Yeah, but see, I got a.
Some lamb, some cooked chickpeas, some mystery vinaigrette.
See, the vegetables are all in here.
And he has.
So these are the peppers that the hot sauce is from. And the reason I don't know is I got a bunch of plants from my friend Sam Cass, and I planted them, but I don't know what they are. So, but it's hot as hell. And then these are regular jalapenos.
Did he plant them in the White House garden?
No,
Did they rip out the White House garden?
No, they can't.
They can't.
No, okay. I garden, so this is from my garden.
I don't know what they are. They're not ghost chilies.
They're not ghosts.
They're not Carolina Reapers.
Nope. They are pretty hot. So let's do.
So the nicest and most simple presentation of lamb, I think, to me in New York is Buvette.
I haven't been.
Where she just slices lamb, puts it on a plate. It's cold lamb, roasted. Uh-huh. It's salsa verde on a small plate. Just sit in the tiny little place, Jody's place. It's great. So Parisian in style. Where's this lamb from?
This is from Fleischer's.
Okay.
Shop. Yep. And, you know, there was, did they, I forgot the name of the farm it came from, but it's one of those great artisanal butchers that we have here in Brooklyn.
Okay, let me explain what we've got going. Tom's got stewed chickpeas with a simple vinaigrette and a little bit of beautiful lettuces and the shaved lamb on a plate. And it's just a little light snack, but it could be a lunch. And it, I mean, but the idea of cooking, I think that what chefs are really good at is the understanding of that leftovers and the contents of your fridge become mise en place.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, meanwhile, they're already prepped. They're already ready to go. So it's how you reassemble them into a, you know, a meal.
I, you know, my wife sort of jokes around that I have the soul of a Depression era housewife because I don't, you know, I can repurpose food. But leftovers are great.
But that, I think that repurposing food is key, and it's one of the reasons why America has kind of lost the skill set in cooking is because they don't know how to do that. Nice.
Hold on. Got a little bit of that.
So what's your favorite restaurant in the neighborhood?
There's a place called Meta down the street.
Mm-hmm.
All wood burning. I don't get out much these days. I really do not go out.
Well, the boys are what, 7 and 9?
7 and 9.
What's the point in going out?
Yeah. Like, I find I cook at home more these days than I cook in restaurants.
I know that feeling.
And that just, you know, it works for me. You know, the thing is that people forget about or don't know about chefs. They think the chefs are out there cooking. Well,
no, the chefs are running a team.
Right. So,
and yeah.
Here's the example I give. If you go to hear a symphony, right, the person who wrote that music is probably long gone. Mm-hmm. Right? Who gets top billing? The conductor. Okay. Now, in the middle of conducting, you don't expect that conductor to jump in a pit and start, you know, and pick up a cello and start playing. And maybe this conductor can, but you don't want that to happen. I mean, it would be all chaos. I mean, music would just stop. Someone has to conduct it. So as chefs, that's what we do. We conduct the kitchen. Doesn't mean we're playing the instruments.
Yeah.
The cooks are playing the instruments. Sous chefs maybe a little more, but as a chef, you're creating the dishes. You're creating the recipes. It's your style of management. You're hiring the people, or at least, you know, putting the parameters in place for mm-hmm. the kind of people that you want to hire. I want to say the kind of people, meaning the temperament of the people who work for you.
The tenor.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always equate it to being a baseball manager and fielding a team. And you're always balancing, but you have to make changes. And mm-hmm. you have to be reactive. And that's the job of the chef, is to be that reactive person to figure out who's got strengths and fortes at right. that moment.
Right. Speaking of baseball managers, why do they wear uniforms?
That's a good question.
It's silly. Think about this. How silly is that? I mean, football? Does, like, you know, you see the manager wear, like, a football uniform? No.
That would be awesome.
Belichick comes the closest to that. He wears, like, a, you know, tattered, you know, sweatshirt, hoodie with a logo on it. But, no. Baseball. I mean, really? Basketball. Could you imagine if the coach sat there on the bench with, like, you know, warm-ups on? No. This doesn't happen. Why in baseball?
Yeah, that's a really good, yeah, that, I don't know.
Silly.
I don't know.
Crazy.
So, okay, the boys are growing up.
Yeah.
One's already grown mm-hmm. up, and is a man now at 25. What do you teach? What do you think, even if they're not your kids, what do you think that, and this is not future chefs, but what do you teach every human who's 16? What are the three cooking skills that they need to know? Or three fundamental pieces of cooking that they need to understand to be able to help them in the future?
I think three things: roasting, braising. So obviously the braise, you got to make stocks and stuff, but you don't really have to. But roasting, braising, and how to cook a green vegetable.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are three things that can sort of, you can create a repertoire of dishes around those three things. Obviously there's a lot that go into that, and there's shopping and things like that, but really, just sort of the basics.
Yeah.
I mean, I say roasting because sautéing is something you don't really do that much anymore, but like pan roasting, oven roasting, braising, you do that, you can
You can do.
And cook a green vegetable. And then if you figure out how to like make potatoes, you can make Thanksgiving. You can do, you know, you can put a meal on the table.
Yeah.
With those couple things.
But I think, yeah, I mean, yeah, to me, it's always like, okay, you make a vinaigrette and you roast a chicken.
Right.
And you learn how to assemble a salad.
Right.
And cook grains. Maybe that's four things, but with those, because I think the failure in teaching humans about food has often been that we teach recipes and not technique.
Well, that's my whole first book was about, Think Like a Chef.
Yeah.
The idea that move away from recipes. And that exactly is the problem. And I'll equate that to music again. You can play guitar.
Right.
And you can learn a few chords. You learn three chords, you can do a song.
You can riff.
Okay. You can sit there and do, you know, a bunch of different songs. You don't know music. You know a few chords. And so it's the same thing with cooking. If you learn recipes, all you learn are those recipes. You don't learn how to cook. Now, if you cook enough, maybe it'll start to sort of sink in. For me, it's all about techniques. I mean, that's why Jacques Pepin's book, La Technique, was it kind of changed my life cooking-wise.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's all he was focused on. There were some recipes to illustrate techniques, but it was really about learning how to roast and saute and braise and learn how to make stocks and learn how to cook a green vegetable and learn how to, you know, cook root vegetables. Once you knew that, then you can do anything. Then you don't have to rely on, like, the recipe. And part of the reason why I kind of, the reaction I had to that book was I most likely would have been diagnosed with ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a hard time reading through a recipe. I'd look at it, and it's like, none of it didn't make sense to me, and it seemed like it was long. I couldn't really figure out what they were trying to, and I'd get frustrated. I'd put it down and just do my own thing. But once I saw this book, and he talked about learning techniques, and once you learn techniques and learn how to make sauces and learn how to make stocks, you could do anything. It was like, wow, this kind of unlocks something. And so to me, that's what it's all about. I mean, the idea, my first book, Think Like a Chef, that's what I did. It starts with techniques. And in fact, I would have kept recipes out of the book completely, except the publisher wouldn't let me. You know, once you get that under your belt, then it's a matter of practice. That's the other thing the whole time. How to become a better chef? How to become a better cook? Cook.
Yeah.
You know, that's it.
Cook and read.
Cook. Yeah. Cook and read. But cook. Cook with intention too. When you don't just kind of, that's the problem with recipes. You don't cook with intention. You're just kind of going through the paces. You're not actually in there looking and paying attention to the way food reacts to heat, the way food reacts to acid, the way your palate reacts to these various textures and temperatures, things like that. So, you know, very few people, they put something in the pan, they turn away, and then they come back and it's burnt, and they're like, oh, shit.
Or,
stay here.
The fact that when we write recipes for a home book that we have to say, you know, saute for 5 minutes until this happens.
Right.
You know, my editor, you know, Francis, is always like, give me a visual cue. What are you trying to say? And it's like, no, you just get it or you don't.
Right.
Paul Bertoli had one of the most brilliant written recipes, and I think the second Shape and Ease book. And it talked about risotto. And it was like a 3-page tome recipe about risotto. And eventually it culminated with, I can't tell you when it's done. You just need to learn when it's done.
Right.
And, you know, so I can't say, well, risotto cooks in about 17 and a half minutes. It does, but you don't know because there's so many variations and nuances to food. But that I think is what technique, as you bring it up with Pepin's technique book, the understanding of atomized technique gives the ability to understand food nuance.
Right.
And nuance is what doesn't exist in a recipe that you just run through from start to finish.
No. When I was working on Think Like a Chef, I was doing this soup, and it was a bunch of root vegetables. And I had a, you know, good size, you know, small rondeau, you know, whatever. And I had some oil in the bottom of the pan, and I had all the vegetables cut, and they were all mixed. I'm doing this dish and soup, and all the vegetables are cut, and they're all mixed up too. And I go to the stove, and I start adding vegetables. And I just add, you know, a handful. Let it sit. And wait a little longer, add it some more. Wait a little longer, add it some more. And Kathy Young, who was doing all the recipe testing and co-writer of the book, she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm just adding vegetables to the pan. She goes, no, there's something that you're doing here. And I had to think about it. And I realized what I was doing is, so when you put, you know, you have your pan, there's some heat in it. It's not scorching hot, but there's some heat in it. If I were to dump all those vegetables in there at once,
you're going
to
create steam.
Right. The heat would just drop off. Mm-hmm. It would just steam and turn to mush. And so I just knew that if I had a little time, and she said, well, how are you judging it? I said, oh, I'm listening to it. She said, "You're listening to it." I said, "Yeah, I'm listening to the pan. The pan has a certain, you know, there's a crackle that it's making, and I'm just listening for when it starts to get really fast and really sort of intense. You have to add more, and then you keep adding, and you keep adding enough where that crackle's going the whole time. This way, you know you're actually sautéing it as opposed to starting to steam it. And then once that gets done, then you add the stock, and I add the stock the same way, a little at a time to keep that temperature up, so it doesn't just stop cooking." And she said, "I've never seen that before. No one's ever talked about it before." I said, "Well," she goes, "how did you learn that?" I said, "Just intuition. It's kind of..."
It's the exact same intuition that says when you walk by a prep cook and he's roasting a bunch of vegetables that they're on a sheet pan and he's got absolutely no space between each of the vegetables. Right. You're going to be, and you're cooking that in a 375 degree oven. You're just going to come up with steamed vegetables because you've overcrowded it and it doesn't have the allowance that the heat is going to individually hit all sides of that. But that's nuance.
Well, when the liquid starts coming out of the vegetable, instead of immediately evaporating, it just pools.
Yeah.
That's
the cooking nuance that I think differentiates people who are really culinarily inclined as to people who don't. It's interesting you bring up ADHD, and I'm kind of the same way. I don't have, let's put it this way, I probably started thousands of books and finished 150.
I've only published your book for 6 years now.
right. But that's an intriguing part of, I think, that the freneticism of chefdom is really attractive to people. I had one therapy guy once told me, he was like, "You definitely picked the right occupation for your personality and your freneticism." And I was like, "Yep."
Yeah, same here. I was so comfortable in the kitchen.
Yep.
From day one, walking and going, "Oh, this just..."
Yeah, I was never comfortable in high school and studying and all that. Same. And I worked starting at 15 in kitchens, and it was the one place where I felt like I just belonged and I was really good at it. And it fit.
It came easy, too. It came really easy. It was like, "Oh, that's this isn't difficult."
No.
There's nothing difficult about this.
It's, yeah.
And I enjoyed it. It's fun. And I still do, which is, I'm so happy. In fact, I started gardening about 5 years ago, and that got me cooking again, and, you know, in a different way, like really kind of paid attention to what's coming out of the ground and noticing the difference between something, the day you pick it versus a day later and how it changes. But I enjoy it. There's something, but more so than the act of cooking is just bringing people to their house around your table, having a good time, because I think, especially nowadays, it's, you want those moments. We're all so damn busy, and so if you could take those 2-3 hours to cook, recall, make a meal,
and just enjoy it,
and just sit back,
over the purity of something so simple as food. Yeah. I want to talk about two things. First is how you view your food cooking. How has your food changed over the last 20 years? The food that you're really excited about cooking for patrons. And then I want to talk about the changing American palates, because you and I have talked about this before vis-a-vis Top Chef, as to what resounds with American palates now versus what it did 20 years ago.
Sure.
So first, like, how has your food changed? Like, what do we, I mean, are you cooking with kimchi?
Yeah, so I'll go back to when I opened Colicchio and Sons. So we had Kraft Steak and we changed it to Colicchio and Sons. And that menu was, I want to say, a little more eclectic, using spices from around the world, not being afraid to introduce different flavors. Where, you know, I look back to when I was at Gramercy, for instance, it was all pretty much French Italian. Never used anything with spice or soy or yogurt or cumin or Bieber or Uber Bieber or
better
right.
Vaudevant.
Any of that stuff, right? Vaudevant. And all of a sudden, this was all on that menu, and I did it because, you know, for me, that was exciting at the time. That's what I wanted to cook. I wanted to incorporate some of these ideas and flavors into the food that I had been doing. And Kraft was very different. Kraft was purposely a very simple, straightforward restaurant where I didn't want to introduce any other flavors. I wanted just the purity of the food itself. So this was something different. And I really enjoyed it. It was it was fun creating that menu, and I thought it was really exciting. And but you know, so the project I'm working on now is more of a it's a first restaurant outside of an urban area, and so the food is we're trying to do something more approachable.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still some curveballs in there. There's still you know things that people are going to have fun with, but it's more. I don't want to say basic, but just kind of straightforward. A lot of salads, a lot of, mm-hmm. you know, pastas and stuff that's just approachable. And,
yeah.
And but it's also stuff that I want to eat. You know, I don't want to be challenged every time I go out to dinner. I don't want to have to think that hard, you know, when I'm eating.
I think that in restaurants, I think the Joe Beef guys are the best at doing that. Delivering such authenticity and zeal in food that in a lot of ways is just really simple and really straightforward.
Yeah.
But it means that it's imminently sellable. I mean, it's just every time it's another place where I could eat. I mean, I don't think my arteries could afford that luxury, but I could eat it every day. So, you know, food with exploration, I think learning and how our way of cooking has changed is always marked to me by positioning myself, and I think you do the same thing, not as an expert, but as somebody thoroughly into the craft of what you do, allowing for constant learning and allowing for the impacts of globalism and the way things are shipped around the world now and influences to be more readily available to the food that we have always done. But the introduction of Berber and Vadovan and all those things are really interesting to me because I luckily have food is an endless topic to me. Mm-hmm. I can learn about it every day and never get tired of it. I think that's key to the way I look at food. So you and I were sitting one time after an episode of filming Top Chef, and we were talking about, I can't even remember the particular dish, but something that was very good, but the reason it was very good was that it was packed with tons of flavors, with spice and acidity and umami, and that wouldn't have been necessarily appreciated 20 years before by the American public when we were stuck on very pedestrian and relatively bland continental food.
Right.
So how did that change happen in the American market to allow for people in Iowa City to want kimchi in their food?
Yeah, so I agree. I think, you know, when we're actually judging, that's something that we're really cognizant of because we know that sugar, some sweetness, spice, that umami, that's hard to beat in a dish. And sometimes you got to look through that. And so that's why when I judge, I'm always looking at technique first.
Mm-hmm.
Something cooked properly, something seasoned properly. And then I'm looking at composition because it's too easy to get sucked into those flavors. I think in terms of the American palate, it's changed because we are, you know, again, I'll go back to urban areas. There's so much ethnic food that we kind of grew up on. So it used to be, yeah, we were used to eating continental food, but we had Chinese. And that Chinese food, you craved it. Why'd you crave it? And there's a lot of MSG in there. There's some fermented things in there. There's umami. There's definitely sugar. I think it's like General South chicken.
Mm-hmm.
It's loaded with sugar.
Black bean sauce
loaded with sugar. So we kind of started like craving that. And then, you know, a lot of young chefs who travel a lot more. I think the internet has something to do with this too, because, you know, it used to be if you wanted to learn, you know,
French food, you went to France. Or, now you can go to France on the internet.
Thailand, you got to go to Thailand. Nowadays, you go on the internet and hit a few buttons and you're there.
Yeah.
And so, but I think that as Americans became food obsessed, they started to branch out and they started to travel and they started to want more, understand more. And so now you can have, you know, a Thai American chef, you know, cooking Scandinavian food, you know, in Brooklyn. And it's kind of okay. It all kind of works. It's fine. And but I think it's because the American palate is just more open to those flavors. And I think we're becoming, you know, used to them. I mean, think about this. 40 years, 50 years ago, you know what was weird? Eating yogurt.
Some days I still think eating yogurt is weird.
This is the new thing, yogurt.
Some people cannot accept yogurt, like, genetically. I don't think they can. It's really weirdly tart and textural. I like yogurt.
How was it sold? It was sold that there's this little town in Russia where the people live to be 100 years old because they eat yogurt.
Yeah. So what's the new thing like that right now? What are we eating?
Kombucha.
Kombucha, acai, which I don't even know if I pronounced that correctly.
Yeah. I don't know.
That's how new it is. I can't even pronounce it correctly.
But I think in general, Americans, they want more, from their food. I mean, you can think of what's considered, like, growing up, if my mother tried to attempt a Japanese meal, it was like steak teriyaki. That was it.
Yeah. I remember, my dad being on sabbatical in California and us making egg rolls.
Yeah.
From scratch with wrappers. Yeah. And that was, a 1970s delight of globalism happening in our kitchen in Palo Alto.
It was Chungking was the brand. And there was all these sauces and condiments and stuff. And so you had to just, like, slice beef and saute it and then add your condiments and stuff.
It's so funny, though, that perception of Chinese food, now we know so much more. And we search out good Hunan food and great Sichuan food and the different regional ideas of Chinese food, that it's totally, for a topic we thought we knew a lot about, we knew nothing about it, which is totally interesting as to the future of food and how that all breaks down. I always look at the ascension of Starbucks and coffee. Everybody said, all the small coffee shops are going to go away. Well, what they didn't realize was the limited scope of what Starbucks was presenting as coffee. A lot of people wanted something more, and they wanted to nerd out on it.
You know, in a way, it actually
creates that third way.
It became the gateway drug of coffee.
It allowed us to explore coffee, and you've got a great coffee set up right here. It allowed us to explore coffee in that third wave of jumping way in, deep diving into a topic that was thought to be thoroughly learned about. Right. And that, to me, is always a really interesting
I have friends of mine that are like such coffee geeks. They weigh to the gram.
Yep,
and
that's me.
It's all timed, and it's like, okay, cool. But it's also you see the results. Good cup of coffee.
It's funny, at Top Chef, Austin Sipes, who's one of the ADs on the show, and is a very dear friend of both Tom and I's. Austin's got a big coffee set up in his office. Big pour over station and things like that with scales and things like that. Because slowly but surely, during the course of his job on Top Chef, he learned more about coffee. So it's always intriguing. So Top Chef's coming up in Kentucky. And do you see a lot of diversity in the food? Is the food changing this season? Is it always changing?
Yeah, I mean, we how we cast. It's always, we cast for diversity. We cast for not only people, but opinions and experiences. And that's to be expected. This is a good season. I enjoyed the season a lot. Previous seasons, not so much. There was a combination. The chefs were talented.
Mm-hmm.
They're also really good people, but they still competed. And there was a lot of different ideas being thrown around that were very different opinions about food. Having someone do, essentially almost exclusively West African food with West African spices.
That's Eric.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And seeing someone like that. Also, a lot of the chefs were working in smaller markets, whether it was Paducah, Kentucky, or Mobile, Alabama, or other places, but they all worked for a period of time in New York or Chicago. So they worked under really good chefs, and they're going back home, and which is really, this is really why it's so hard to find cooks, but also why more Americans are exploring food and understanding more food. You have these young chefs who they come to the cities, they learn under great chefs, but they want to go home, and they want to build their own thing, and they want to also affordable to open restaurants.
Yeah, I mean, I was living in San Francisco opening up Gary Danko and had to go back to Athens because I couldn't afford to live in San Francisco.
And so it's exciting.
Yeah.
What's weird about it, usually when the season starts, first episode, second episode, challenge, you get a pretty good idea where the field is.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a pretty good idea of who's going to, go a little further. And you can see it right away. You see it in the technique right away. This one, couldn't have picked it all. Couldn't have handicapped this season.
Yeah, usually you've got one or two that I'm just like, oh, yeah, fodder.
Yeah,
You're about to get eaten alive. Because it's stressful. It is a stressful show. I mean, judging it's easy.
Yeah.
I see what you do. And yeah. It's not that hard. Yeah,
it's,
be honest.
It's not actually.
It's good.
It's good. Not. It's not hard at all. But no, the being on the show is you know, you've heard this too. Usually halfway through the season, every chef starts saying, I've never worked this hard. This is the most difficult thing I've ever done in my career. And these are, you know, people who stand on their feet for 80 hours, you know, a week. It's tough. But it was a good season. I was really happy with it.
Yeah.
And going to Macau, which at first I was like, I don't want it. It's a long way to go for a finale. But, you know, there's a good mashup of food. You know, that mac and cheese food that's Portuguese and Chinese. And they would hit the markets. And I was just so happy to see this. You know, you're in the finals, right? And so you're going to, you know, cook food that you know. You don't want to take a risk. They hit the markets and we're just tasting things, all this fermented and dried stuff like dried scallops and shrimp and various fermented things. They would just go and kind of eat and say, all right, I'll make this work.
That's great.
And it was fantastic.
Yeah. So how long can that show exist?
I don't know.
It seems to be a cycle where you guys seem to, like, it culminates and maybe it's in it and then listen, it just seems to get reignited.
We shot 16. We're definitely shooting 17. There's probably talk of 18. As long as the ratings stay up and we keep getting nominated for Emmys, I guess it's going to keep going.
Keep going.
I mean, when they got to wheel me in a wheelchair, maybe it's over for me. But, you know, it keeps giving, which is great. And I think part is because of who we're casting, meaning we're casting really talented chefs, and they all go on to do, you know, great work. I mean, think about, I think we've had like 240-some-odd contestants. It could be 270, something like that, over the 16 seasons. I don't remember exactly, but at least half of them are running restaurants. So yeah, the show just keeps going. It just keeps chugging along and it's grown. I mean, we started, you know, our first season in San Francisco, we had one little truck and I think maybe 30 people on the crew. Now it's like 900 people, yeah. And it's trucks and, you know, it's insane what it's turned into. But
that's great.
I still have fun doing it. You know, it's a blast doing it and
I think it's been an interesting and good part of your career and watching you grow and be so successful. But I think it's the same way with anybody who's a chef on TV. It is about 2% of what we've done in their careers.
Yeah.
And it just gets the most attention.
Yeah. There's a lot of eyeballs on it. But I'm not chefing on TV. I'm just kind of acting as a judge. I'm gonna put on my robe.
A lot of hats. You've been doing a lot of hats lately.
Well, in Kentucky, we had hats. Yeah, Kentucky was, you know, yeah.
Kentucky and Charleston, or South Carolina, wearing hats there,
yeah. Too. Well, it's, you know, I feel good wearing a hat down in Charleston or Kentucky. It felt right.
Yeah.
But, no, the show, listen, I enjoy the show. What I enjoy most is that, you know, some of these young chefs, I never get to meet them or know who they are. And so we were exposed to a lot of young talent and it's a great showcase for them. It's a great showcase for what we can do with food in this country. And I think it's, you know, right now it just keeps chugging along.
It does. No, it's right. It's some of those people I've met throughout the years of doing the show and helping out on it have turned out to be just amazing friends for long.
Really good people.
Really, really interesting. Yep. Just dedicated people. And most of the people I competed with on Top Chef Masters way back in the day, people like Tracy Desjardins, you know, like my sister now. So it's been a good thing. Well, Tom, thanks for having us over.
Sure.
It's been a good place. I'm going to go take Piper for a walk.
Yeah, Piper's, she's over there looking
for food.
She's sleeping. Well, the lamb came out, so she got excited. She thought she was getting some.
Yeah, but she's 10, then she got tired.
Yeah, she got a little tired. She got sidetracked.
This episode of Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot was taped on location in Brooklyn, New York. Scott Porch produces the show for Himalaya Media with field recording by Brian Blum, sound design by Alex Ramsey, and editing by Brendan Lynch Solomon and Jason Smith. Thanks to Peter Vincer at Himalaya Media for coming along on the trip and for his insight into all things podcasts. Please follow Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like what you hear, rate and review. Come back on Tuesdays for new episodes. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Hugh Atchison. Thanks for listening. Eat well, be swell.